Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting the film series Testigo Witness, Goya in the Movies. Held on select Fridays in May, each film touches upon artist Francisco de Goya's visions of the world, kicking off with Pan's Labyrinth by Guillermo del Toro on May 10th at NortonSimon.org.
You have the chance to win a spring super sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
From the Moen Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Sharon McNary, filling in for Larry this week as he takes a well-deserved vacation. Larry's back next week. Right now, we're talking about the Salton Sea, California's largest and, I would argue, maybe most troubled lake. Water levels continue to drop, and that poses all kinds of problems for communities nearby and even the fish in the water. The California Natural Resources Agency is tasked with coming up with a plan to address this, and right now several proposals focusing on importing seawater. Joining me now to discuss the problems plaguing the Salton Sea and the proposals aimed at addressing those is Mark Olaldi. He's an environment reporter with ProPublica's Southwest office. He's been reporting on this. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with some background on some of the challenges. And I want to add that you wrote just a fantastic, comprehensive report on the problems with the Salton Sea in the Desert Sun and
Yep, it was in the Desert Sun and USA Today, where I was most recently working. And kind of our goal with this piece was to ground truth the question of whether or not these kind of pie in the sky ideas to save the Salton Sea with one massive multi-billion-dollar binational project were really feasible. So we were kind of trying to get to the bottom of whether that's real.
Wow. Well, that sounds like a daunting challenge. So give us some background on why the Salton Sea has so many problems. Why is the water level going down? How long has this been a concern? And the health problems.
Absolutely. And the Salton Sea is just an absolutely fascinating place, partly because there's so many misconceptions about it. Yes, it is in some ways an accidental lake. It was created after the Colorado River was accidentally diverted into the Salton Sink in 1905 by kind of an engineering disaster. But at the same time, this depression, which is a couple hundred feet below sea level, has been filling up and drying out and filling up again for thousands of years. And then we dammed up the entire Colorado, and we kind of need to sleep in the bed we made. And so in 2003, there was this huge water transfer agreement to sell water out of the Imperial Valley, the water that once flowed from farm fields into the Salton Sea, and send it out to the Coachella Valley, to the coast, to Los Angeles, and whatnot. And so this was kind of part of climate change hurting the Colorado River. This was part of Los Angeles and Southern California's kind of ever growth. And because that water that once flowed into the Salton Sea was no longer flowing at such a high level, the salt levels in the sea started increasing. The lake levels started dropping. More and more of this dust we call playa started becoming exposed to the windy kind of desert air. And, nearby communities, many of which are full of kind of Latino farm workers who already have other health disparity and economic issues, suddenly were hit by this dust that was full of a century's worth of agricultural runoff with pesticides and fertilizers and other nasty stuff in it. So now the state has the responsibility to come up with a solution that's due by the end of 2022. And we're trying to figure out, can we have a massive project to knock out all these issues, refill the lake, clean the water, et cetera? Or is there a piecemeal approach that it's maybe a cheaper, more achievable answer?
And to highlight the urgency of this, describe the health problems that dust is creating.
Sure. And it's kind of just compounding a lot of other issues. You know, these agriculture heavy areas already have pesticide spray, and these desert areas already have dust blowing. And so there is already high levels of asthma. But we're seeing, you know, factors above kind of national or state averages of asthma and other respiratory issues in in communities living around this lake. And in addition to the health disparities, we're also seeing this as a huge environmental catastrophe. California has lost nearly all of its wetlands over the past 100 years to development, agriculture, et cetera. And we're right smack dab in the middle of the Pacific Flyway, which is a huge migratory bird route from Alaska down to, you know, down to South America. And so the Salton Sea was once vibrant fish habitat, which meant once vibrant bird habitat for migratory birds that fed on these fish. And now you can't survive in the lake. And so it's no longer that habitat. So it's got a component of human health. It's got a component of environmental and kind of wildlife health, all really wrapped up in one.
I visited the Salton Sea when I was a kid, so obviously quite a long time ago. And I remember seeing skeletons of fish along the shoreline. I mean, it did not smell nice. It was never a place I'd want to swim. And I imagine it's even worse today. So clearly it urgently needs to be fixed. And there's some 2022 deadline for this. Whose deadline is it and how likely is it to be met?
Exactly. So the end of 2022 deadline is for the state to come up with a draft plan to kind of once and for all say, we're going to stop our looking over here and looking over there and proposing this idea and that idea. We're going to give our actual idea. If kind of we sign off on it, we're going to move forward with it. And that's going to be what we do. Because, you know, frankly, for my readership in the Coachella Valley and the Imperial Valley, they're tired. You know, they've been dealing with these issues for decades. This isn't new. I mean, the problems of the Salton Sea are, to show my age, as old as I am. And no one is really surprised in this area anymore by this. What surprises them is how many studies the state does, how much money the state puts into it. And to the state's credit, they are kind of turning over a new leaf during the Newsom administration and actually moving a bit more quickly on Salton Sea issues. But, you know, the water transfer deal that started all of this was in 2003. And so the 2022 deadline is really to light a fire and come up with one solution and start moving forward on that.
I mean, fish are cut bait, except you wouldn't want the fish in this lake. So there's 11 proposals on the table right now. Who's pushing those proposals forward? And are they all about importing seawater?
Exactly. So those 11 are specifically on seawater importation. A couple of years back, the California Natural Resources Agency put out a request for information saying, we know that this idea of piping in water or otherwise bringing in water to the sea and raising the level that way, we know that a lot of people want that. And so let's give it a fair shake. Let's study that. And then let's decide, is that the answer? Or should we stick with what we're already doing, which is a couple thousand acres of dust suppression here, a couple thousand acres of habitat construction here, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the path we're currently on. These 11 proposals I was digging into are kind of what's come to be known as sea-to-sea water importation. And the most likely route of sea-to-sea is going from the Sea of Cortez, Baja California, south of the border in Mexico, and then likely building a canal roughly 125 miles through the desert, through a dry lake bed called Laguna Salada, south of the border, and then west of the Imperial Valley through Bureau of Land Management land to dump water back into the Salton Sea, raise the level, and cover the playa. The problem, though, and the problems with this are myriad, is that you also need to deal with this huge salinity issue. The Salton Sea right now is about twice as salty as the ocean. And so that needs to be dealt with if you're going to make it habitat again.
Yeah, so adding seawater to saltwater sounds expensive to figure that out.
It is expensive. You know, the thing though with these 11 projects is they range quite a bit. So the gentleman who I include a lot in this story, who's kind of one of the main voices, he's really put a lot of legwork, ton of time into trying to make C2C both viable, economically speaking, as well as just politically speaking. He says he can do this for less than $1 billion. And this is a project that I argue would be the largest water infrastructure project in North America since the Hoover Dam. On the other end of the spectrum, we've got projects $5, $6, $7 billion plus tens of millions of dollars of operation and maintenance every year. But that would come with a lot of other stuff. It would come with entire fields of renewables attached to it to power pumps. It would come with massive mangrove habitats to filter water and kind of clean up the salt and sea that way. So these gentlemen behind these ideas, they're engineers, they're architects, they're big thinkers. But however you slice it, this is going to cost probably $1 billion into several billion dollars.
Yeah, you know, we're Americans. We love our boondoggles. bigger, more expensive. We're talking about the Salton Sea and the various proposals to import seawater to address water level concerns there. I'm talking with environment reporter Mark Walalde. If you have questions about the proposals or what's happening with this body of water, give us a call, 866-893-5722. You can also tweet at AirTalk or comment on our Facebook page. Also joining me is Michael Cohen, senior researcher at the Pacific Institute, which is a think tank based in Oakland that focuses on water conservation issues. We also have Timothy Bradley, Professor Emeritus of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at UC Irvine. He's been working on issues related to the Salton Sea and other salt lakes for decades. Michael and Timothy, thank you for being on Air Talk. Let's start with Professor Bradley. What do you see as the pros and cons of this sea-to-sea proposals that would import water from the Sea of Cortez?
Well, the positive side is that if you could raise the lake level up again and cover the playa, which are dry beaches which have been left behind as the sea shrinks, if you could cover those playa, then you would reduce the emission of toxic dust, which currently is blowing in both the Imperial and the Coachella Valleys and is endangering the health of the people there. So that's the positive side. The negative, and as was pointed out, there are a lot of negatives, but one of the negatives is that you, you have fresh water flowing into the sea, and as it evaporates, the sea is becoming more salty anyway, as salts are brought in by fresh water. If you brought in seawater, you would increase the salinity very rapidly. And it would be equivalent to the Dead Sea. That is to say, there'd be no fish, no invertebrates in the sea in a matter of years. So it would mean the ecological death of the sea. But the advantage is that you would start to address the public health problems, which so far the state has really not addressed adequately.
Oh, my gosh. Well, let's hear from Michael Cohen of the Pacific Institute. Do you see pros and cons in this sea-to-sea plan?
Yes. So there's I think the pro is that it's conceptually easy. People can think because the Salton Sea is below sea level, just take water via gravity from the ocean, which isn't that far away, and fill the sea back to its former elevation. So conceptually, it's an easy concept to grasp. And I think that's why this idea continues for years and years and years. But there's a host of challenges. I think Mark did a good job in his article of pointing out many of them, and one of them he identified as time. So the San Diego County Water Authority is proposing a pipeline also to bring water in from Imperial Valley directly over the mountains to San Diego. And their timeline for that project is about 25 years. So that project would not cross an international boundary. So you don't need to get purchase land or easements in Mexico. You don't need to deal with an international agency. You don't need to deal with the State Department. But it still takes 25 years, based on their estimates, to build that project. So to my mind, that's the single greatest obstacle for these sea-to-sea schemes. Is that it's a generation away before it actually yields results. And we simply don't have that kind of time at the Salton Sea.
Well, is there a quicker way to reduce the problem of the dust and reduce the problem of the lowering water level?
Yes. So the state of California spent many years trying to get its act together. But this year, finally, it's starting construction on the first habitat project at the Salton Sea. It's a 4,000-plus acre habitat project at the lower end of the sea. And the good news is that the voters of California approved bond monies to fund that. The governor is currently funding it, or talking about additional $220 million for salt and sea projects, and it looks like there may be some additional monies coming from the federal government as well. So the combination of these smaller scale habitat cells combined with ongoing dust suppression efforts. So Imperial Irrigation District, which delivers water down there, has already constructed more than 2,000 acres of these dust suppression projects. State of California has constructed about 750 acres of these projects. So that's essentially the pathway. It's a series of feasible small-scale projects that can be built over time. And the good news is that at the Salton Sea is, even though there's going to be much less water flowing into the Salton Sea in the future, there's still a tremendous amount of water will continue to flow there, more than the county of San Diego uses as a whole every year. So the solution, to my mind, really is to optimize the use of that water. If you capture it, you spread it out in these habitat cells, build dust suppression projects, then we can create really good ecological function down there, good habitat for birds, some recreational amenities, and even some economic development for the people down there, and suppress dust. So the challenge with that approach is that it's not very sexy. It's not the heyday of the Salton Sea as some people remember it. But to my mind, it's practical, it's feasible, and it's something we can start doing and are doing right now.
That does sound a little bit similar to what the city of LA has had to do up at Mono Lake to reduce the dust blowing around after it took the water out of there. Am I close?
Well, Owens Lake, certainly. So it's in some ways similar to what they're doing at Owens Lake, which is now covering some of that very dusty playa with some water methods and some dust suppression. So it's expanding on that a little bit. There's a variety of other habitat projects around the state of California. If you look at South San Diego Bay or South San Francisco Bay, you can see salt ponds. So the idea is somewhat similar there, in that you create these little shallow berms, put water in them. And as we saw with a couple of federal projects 10, 15 years ago now, birds very quickly come and colonize those in very, very large numbers.
I'm talking with Michael Cohen of the Pacific Institute and Timothy Bradley, Professor Emeritus at UCI, about proposals to address challenges with the Salton Sea. Also with us is environment reporter Mark Olalde. More to come. I'm Sharon McNary in for Larry Mantle. We'll be back after this quick break.
Support for LAS comes from Wheel Gear Theatricum Botanicum, returning with a season of outdoor summer repertory theater on its scenic stage in the woods of Topanga, with picnicking in the gardens before the show. A Midsummer Night's Dream is back, along with The Winter's Tale, Wendy's Peter Pan, and Tartuffe Born Again, set at a TV station in Baton Rouge. And for a contentious election year, Bernardo Cubría's The Hispanic, Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latin Vote. Tickets at theatricum.com. Support for LAS comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting the world premiere of Mix Mix, the Filipino Adventures of a German Jewish Boy by Boney B. Alvarez. Inspired by true events from the life of Ralph Price, after escaping Nazi Germany, a newfound tropical refuge in the Philippines is upended when Japan invades the islands. On stage through June 16th. Tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
Welcome back to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Sharon McNary, sitting in for Larry Mantle. Thanks for joining us today. We're talking about the different challenges plaguing the Salton Sea, which is located in Riverside and Imperial counties. The California Natural Resources Agency is supposed to come up with a long-term plan to address concerns of the lake level falling and dust blowing in the air. One idea being considered is to import seawater to replenish the Salton Sea. Mark Olalde, a ProPublica environmental reporter, has been helping us break down some of the proposals. Mark, I got a question from John from Palm Springs, and he says, I'm genuinely curious, why is the Salton Sea so important? Why can't it just evaporate off? Could you just irrigate it and use it for agricultural purposes? And then somebody else is asking, well, isn't this, Teresa from Laguna Hills wants to know, is lithium supposed to be harvested at some point for lithium batteries from the Salton Sea? So a lot of curiosity from the public. What's your take on these questions?
Yeah, and those are great questions. And that's a common theme we hear in the reporting around the Salton Sea is this, you know, come on, guys, let's stop wasting money. Let's let this dry and use our resources in other ways. Well, as Michael pointed out, you know, there's still a lot of water coming in. And so if we do nothing, that doesn't mean the Salton Sea dries up. That means it becomes very small and there's a huge playa with full of that toxic dust that Dr. Bradley talked about. So then what do we do with, you know, the hundreds of thousands of people that live in the Coachella and Imperial Valleys and still have to breathe this? Plus, you know, I would make the argument that this was designated as an agricultural sump, you know, I want to say about a century ago by the federal government, meaning the federal government said, all right, let the irrigation water go into this. We know whatever, you know, it's got stuff in it that it maybe isn't great for you, but like, let's let that happen. Let's let the Salton Sea be that sump. So the government, you know, the government 100 years ago kind of made this our problem. So I would argue that letting these communities, like I said, many of which are Latino, lower income, farm working communities, I would say that letting them suffer based on decisions that the government made years ago is probably not the humane and correct thing to do. As far as lithium, there's a blue ribbon commission that's been championed by Assemblymember Eddie Garcia out of Coachella to study the idea of lithium, geothermal, things like that, coming from the south end of the Salton Sea. The Earth's crust is pretty thin down the south end of the Salton Sea, so we know there's a lot of potential for geothermal energy that's been tied to lithium production, which is going to be vital, absolutely vital in batteries if we're going to have a clean energy revolution. And you know, I will say for some of the groups that are proposing these 11 kind of really big C2C ideas, they've fully taken those ideas of lithium production and other renewables that can be tied to their projects, and they're really trying to tie them in, partly in an effort to be green and partly in an effort to make this economically feasible because of that multi-billion dollar likely price tag. So
that is an exciting possibility for sure. Let's go to Michael Cohen of the Pacific Institute in Oakland. They focus on issues in water conservation. Also, Timothy Bradley, professor of emeritus of ecology and evolutionary biology at UC Irvine. Michael, we were talking earlier about timing and resources. What is the danger in waiting years to fix the Salton Sea?
So we're seeing a lot of those dangers realized already. As was pointed out, the salinity of the Salton Sea now is about double ocean water salinity. So when the Water Transfer Agreement was signed back in 2003, the idea was that in the next 15 years, the state of California would jump in, preserve salinity, and start building these habitat and dust suppression projects before the lake became too salty for fish. Essentially, that window is almost completely closed. There's still a few fish left in the Salton Sea. But most of the birds that were eating those fish, the pelicans and cormorants and others, have moved on. One of the challenges there is there's not that many other places for these birds to go because California's dried up so many of its wetlands. And the other really pressing problem is public health. So as Dr. Bradley mentioned, there's some 20,000 acres plus of playa, this lake bed that's been exposed. So recent reports suggested that there's more than 400 tons of dust were released per year into those communities that already suffer from disproportionately high rates of asthma, elderly or hospitalized. So it's a public health and ecological health concern.
And Professor Bradley, looking at the economics and the economic possibilities that might come with fixing the lake, what's in this? Some of these plans for Mexico and the Mexican economy?
Well, the idea was that the United States might be paying for some of that water, and also that it would also restore some of the communities in Mexico where water is flowing through. But it is also opposed by some communities in Mexico as well. And there's also the problem that taking water out of the Sea of Cortez damages the marine resources there in the same way that a desalination plant does. You're sucking up seawater and damaging the ecosystem there. So there's some real challenges from that point of view. I just wanted to return to one of the issues, what you were talking about, Mono Lake and Owens Lake. and the restoration efforts that have gone on there. Mm-hmm. The city of Los Angeles has spent $2.2 billion at Owens Lake on dust suppression. So we should just be aware of the fact that even if these smaller and scalable dust suppression activities go on, we're still talking billions and billions of dollars that the state is going to have to invest in an ongoing and constant attempt to keep the dust down.
Well, it's certainly a thorny problem with a lot of potential solutions, but also a lot of potential expensive pitfalls. I want to thank my guests for joining me today. Mark Olalde is an environment reporter for ProPublica's Southwest office. You can read his extensive reporting on this topic in the Desert Sun. Also, my thanks to Michael Cohen, Pacific Institute researcher, and Timothy Bradley, professor emeritus of ecology and evolutionary biology at UC Irvine. When we come back, we'll talk about some of LA's most significant LGBTQ landmarks, and we want to know what your favorite one is. Go ahead, give us a call at 866-893-5722. We're taking your calls now.
Support for LAS comes from Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum, returning with a season of outdoor summer repertory theater on its scenic stage in the woods of Topanga, with picnicking in the gardens before the show. A Midsummer Night's Dream is back, along with The Winter's Tale, Wendy's Peter Pan, and Tartuffe Born Again, set at a TV station in Baton Rouge. And for a contentious election year, Bernardo Cubrias, The Hispanic, Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latin Vote. Tickets at theatricum.com. Support for LAS comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting American Mariachi by Jose Cruz Gonzalez. It's the 1970s and women can't be mariachis. Or can they? American Mariachi is a feel-good comedy about familia, amor, and tradición that will send your heart soaring and put a bounce in your step with a wave of vibrant, infectious live music. On stage through June 9th, tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Sharon McNary, filling in for Larry today as he takes a well-deserved vacation. While many people think about LGBTQ history in the United States, their minds tend to go to New York City, where the legacies of the Stonewall Rebellion and AIDS-era activist groups like ACT UP loom large. But Los Angeles also has long been a hotbed for queer resistance and activism. From a downtown LA donut shop where gay and transgender people held off a police bust by throwing donuts and coffee at officers, to the home of a reverend who started an LGBTQ-friendly church out of his living room in the 60s, LA has no shortage of meaningful landmarks. Now, we want to hear from you. What are the LGBTQ landmarks in Los Angeles that mean the most to you and why? Give us a call at 866-893-5722. You can also tweet at AirTalk or leave a comment on the Facebook page. Joining me now to discuss this is Arit John, lifestyle reporter for the Los Angeles Times and co-author of the piece 20 Landmarks That Underscore LA's Pivotal Role in the Fight for LGBTQ Rights. Welcome, Arit.
Thanks for having me.
What a great lineup of places. I kind of feel like I want to throw a few in of my own, going back to the AIDS crisis. But in the course of writing this piece, what history of resistance and activism of LGBTQ people in LA really stood out for you?
I think, oh my gosh, there's so much that stood out to me. I mean, while I was researching this piece, it just sort of occurred to me how you can be born in a city, you can live here, grow up here, go to school here, and just constantly walk by places and not realize the history of those places. You can go to Griffith Park and not know the history of the Kissins there. You can go to downtown and not realize like that's where Cooper Donuts used to be, and that there before, like 10 years before Stonewall, there was a rebellion here. And I think just seeing the community in all of this, the way that like a lot of these spaces and all of these landmarks grew out of like trying to build community as well as gain rights, and also trying to like provide healthcare, provide safety. So I think I was just really overwhelmed by how sort of the ways that the history has kind of been forgotten. Like, a lot of these places aren't landmarks, but they're still there. And just like how deep the history went, even just looking at this small survey that we did, like 20 is just really the tip of the iceberg.
I would agree with that. I mean, we do hear a lot about queer activism in New York City. Why do you think we hear less about that in the LA context? Is it the media as monolith that took so long to recognize the importance of these places in people's lives? Was it stigma? Where do you see the lack of info about LA?
I think it's a lot of factors. I mean, in general, you know, there's always this sort of idea that New York and the East Coast has more history, has more culture than LA. But I think it may have been sort of the timing. Like Cooper Donuts was smaller than Stonewall and it happened 10 years sooner. But I think that it's not for lack of trying. There has been so much, we have the One Center here, we have the June L. Mazur Center, our archives. So there has been this effort to sort of like preserve and maintain the history and collect people's records. But I think in general too, it's just sort of hard to, like a lot of these landmarks are sort of based off of first person recollections, like people trying to remember things that happened 20, 30, 40 years ago. And I think memory can be fallible and people don't always have the records to keep track of things and how they happen. But I mean, that's a hard question to answer.
Now, on the list that you helped compile, you include the homes of Morris Kite and the Reverend Troy Perry, who both used their homes to hold activist meetings and build community amongst other LGBTQ people. Now, I remember as a young reporter in the early 80s having a lengthy conversation with Mo Kite about the archive he was creating, his pride at the rich history it represented. And at the time, he was still looking for a permanent home and worried that it might not find a home. And it's interesting to think that these are now just houses in people's neighborhoods and that people in the area might not even know the history of their next door neighbors. What's been the push to preserve these homes and other similar sites as landmarks?
There's an effort right now to preserve Morris Kite's house as a landmark, but I mean, it is a house in like a nice neighborhood, and there is this, I mean, the owners of the building want to redevelop it. And so I think that in general, there's sort of been this, like the difficulty is a lot of these buildings or these landmarks are in areas that are either gentrifying or they're owned by developers. And it's that constant push between like, do we preserve a place as a landmark or do we like tear it down, build it up into something else? I think what was so interesting to me though, is like you said, like that this is just a house in a neighborhood and people could walk by that house every day and not realize that, like, I mean, Morris Kite's house, that's where he did work to co-found the Christopher Street West group that founded the first legally permitted gay pride parade in the US. I mean, he helped found the LA LGBTQ Center and of course the Gay Liberation Front there. So know that like so much activist work was done in just like a nice little one-story house in Westlake. I mean, I think that's amazing. And I think it goes back to this idea of that if you preserve and document the history, then it gives people an idea of like what that work that's been done. And because we haven't, there aren't as many landmarks, that's why a lot of this history can kind of be forgotten if you're not looking for it.
Right. And it's also validating the personhood of those who lived through it and those for whom it was really important. Also joining me is Joseph Hawkins, director of the One National Gay and Lesbian Library and Archives, the largest repository of LGBTQ materials in the world. Joseph, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
And, you should know, what are now the greatest challenges with keeping an archive of LGBTQ history, particularly in, you know, a far-flung city like Los Angeles?
Well, actually, our archive is so large that that's part of why we became part of the University of Southern California in 2010. I mean, we have an enormous amount of material, including, by the way, Morris Kite's art collection. So that, in fact, does reside at the archive. But it's a real challenge because, number one, students in high schools across the United States, many of them never learn anything about LGBT history. They're not able to access that history. So when I teach them at the University of Southern California, I often find that they are indeed not aware of many of these things that we're talking about today. So that's one challenge. And the second challenge is, in the old days, when people used to come to One, they would whisper and say, we found this this thing and do you want it? And I would say you don't have to whisper here, but then later on, when things came in, they started to ask us, how much do you want for this? And I think that that whole conversation, it has shown me that people do value things that are LGBT related now, but that's only been since the 1990s, actually. One's collection started in the 1950s. And so there's an enormous amount of information about a lot of the firsts that happened here. There were the first gay and lesbian center, the first of so many things, the first church, the first synagogue, all of these things happened here in Los Angeles. So I think that it's really important to understand that the history that it has happened here is fantastically important, and we need to preserve it.
Well, describe some of the really significant documents that are at the One Archives and Library.
Well, there's, for instance, a letter that came from the Immigration and Naturalization Service in the 1970s that told two men who had procured a marriage license in Colorado that they, in fact, but they lived here in Los Angeles, that it, in fact, was not a bona fide for two faggots to get married. And that was in a government document. We have positive things, though. We have people's beautiful personal belongings. My favorite in our collection is Lisa Benn's guitar case. Lisa Benn published the first lesbian zine in 1947. The guitar case is just adorable. It's leopard skin on the outside and pink velvet on the inside. And we all love that particular object because it speaks to a particular hero in our community. So there are lots and lots of things like that that are physical objects, but also we have Der Einige, which was a publication that came out of Weimar, Germany. We have materials that go back to the very founding of many of the organizations that are here in Los Angeles. So our collection is really vast, and it really does help us to tell the stories that we're talking about today.
Now, I lived through the AIDS crisis and have actually visited the, you know, the squares on the AIDS quilt of friends of mine who died. What did the AIDS crisis do, for better or worse, in preserving and identifying things that are important as landmarks and as archives?
Well, for an entire generation, I feel like all I did was go to people's homes who were dying.
Oh, God, yes.
And so what I would do is go to someone's home and they would say, oh, well, you know, Harry lived here, but these are his things. And so I would end up picking them up. And so that was really important. I also think it's really important for us to recognize the extent to which lesbians lent a hand in the gay and lesbian community to gay men during the pandemic and how that entire story needs to be told. But also, one of the things that you touched upon before that becomes really interesting to me is, why does Los Angeles not get more attention? And part of it is because Los Angeles is such a huge city that it's really difficult for people to sort of create protest marches. And so for ACT UP in the 1980s and 90s, they had difficulty in getting attention here in Los Angeles and often weren't covered by the media. So a number of those kinds of issues are found within our collections. And there are some really great people who were doing work around AIDS here in Los Angeles, including Phil Wilson and Alan Bell, who published the first national gay black magazine called BLK. So I think that there's some really, really fascinating history there that needs to be exhumed and examined, and we really need to do a lot more of that.
For sure. Well, I'm speaking with Joseph Hawkins, director of One National Gay and Lesbian Library and Archives, the largest repository of LGBTQ materials in the world. Also, Arete John, lifestyle reporter for the Los Angeles Times. We want to hear from you. What landmarks in Los Angeles mean the most to you? Give us a call, 866-893-5722. Lightning round. Arete, name your top three landmarks that are like must-see in Los Angeles.
Oh, tough question. I think that going to the Black Cat in Silver Lake, just to get a sense of that history, since that is one of the early protest sites that's still there, I think going to Catch One, or Jules Catch One, which is now Catch One, that was purchased and then renamed to sort of maintain that legacy, And I think going to Griffith Park, I mean, just seeing the merry-go-round and just like seeing thinking about the history of what happened there.
Well, let's talk to James about his choice. James, where do you think is a great historic landmark?
Yeah, so I was personally thinking it would be Jules Catch 1. And for me, it's kind of partly how the building looks. It's nostalgic. It's not really an official designated monument. And I loved the idea that, you know, so long ago it was kind of created to create a safe haven for Black people who, you know, were discriminated against in, you know, at the time, majority white nightclubs or bars. And
now, do you have the knowledge to like walk us inside? What would we see there?
You know, I've never even been inside. I've only seen photos of the exterior. And to me, it just really resonated because it's not something that you, it just looks very nostalgic. And it's, you know, something that I would like to see kept.
I think we lost James, but thank you very much for that description. Also, I wanted to ask about, political activism picked up pretty significantly in the mid-20th century, especially in L.A. I was at a county board of supervisors meeting when ACT UP, at the end of the Pledge of Allegiance, when people say, "And justice for all," they turned that into a chant and rushed the dais where the supervisors were. And I think it shook them up so badly that the next week there was plexiglass installed between the supervisors and the audience, plexiglass that remains there to this day. What were the conditions of life like for LGBTQ people in the middle of the 20th century and later? And what was the relationship between police? My question is to Joseph.
Well, I think that before Stonewall and in those years, people were actually very closeted and quiet. And a lot of the activism that came after that was really about visibility issues. The idea that of a Stonewall and of all of the other things that we've been talking about, the Cooper's Donuts riots and things, were that we are here and we demand that you see us. I think prior to that time, when you look back in the 1920s and 30s and 40s, there was an enormous amount of underground activity going on, and that activity sort of happened in the dark, and it was a long time before people got to come out and really speak to having recognition.
Well, and there's a place in Pasadena, the Boulevard, which I'm told is Pasadena's only gay bar, is struggling to stay afloat. There's many other places that may have closed during the pandemic. What do we lose historically when these bars do close?
Well, I think that a lot of the bar, the things that were useful in bars, the meeting places, the places to get together, has been replaced in large part by the internet and social media. So I think that when we lose something in one space, we reoccupy it in another. So I think that, you know, the occupation of the social media spaces has really replaced bars, and that's part of the reason that we're seeing them disappear. But I do think that face-to-face communication is really important, and I'm really sad that a lot of them are going away. For me, bars were the very best way to get access to other people in my community, and they were also fraught because in the early days in the 1960s, when I started going to gay bars, you had to sort of sneak in. But later, and almost always in Ohio, where I'm from, they were in from the back door. But here in Los Angeles, you could go to places that had windows, actually, which was a big surprise to me. So the whole ways that spaces are used in California really has changed a lot over the years.
Oh, that's really interesting. Arit, let's talk about the wall, Las Memorias, the AIDS monument. Why is that worth going and seeing at least once in your life?
Beautiful monument. There are six panels that sort of depicts like LGBTQ life in the Latino community, and then two panels that list the names of people who've died of AIDS complications. But I think also just the history of that, it sort of goes back to what I was saying about how so much of the activism is just geared towards like making sure that like people have like healthcare access, that people have knowledge of like, okay, this is how you can like take care of yourself. These are the resources that are available to you, especially if you're in a marginalized community, might not have that access. And I think this monument is also about just like remembering people and like taking the stigma out of that and just giving families a place to remember their loved ones and grieve. And I think it's also just, I mean, it was dedicated on December 1st, World AIDS Day in 2004. And it's the first, I believe the first publicly funded AIDS memorial in the US. And so I think just thinking about the, like the way things have changed and like the work that had to be done to get that monument up, all of it together, I think it's just a beautiful place to visit in LA.
An essential LA point of interest. We'll continue this conversation after the break. Please stay with us.
Support for LAS comes from Wheel Gear Theatricum Botanicum, returning with a season of outdoor summer repertory theater on its scenic stage in the woods of Topanga, with picnicking in the gardens before the show. A Midsummer Night's Dream is back, along with The Winter's Tale, Wendy's Peter Pan, and Tartuffe Born Again, set at a TV station in Baton Rouge. And for a contentious election year, Bernardo Cubría's The Hispanic, Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latin Vote. Tickets at theatricum.com. Support for LAS comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting American Mariachi by Jose Cruz Gonzalez. It's the 1970s and women can't be mariachis. Or can they? American Mariachi is a feel-good comedy about familia, amor, and tradición that will send your heart soaring and put a bounce in your step with a wave of vibrant, infectious live music. On stage through June 9th, tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
Welcome back to Air Talk. I'm Sharon McNary, subbing in for Larry Mantle this week. I'm talking with Arit John, lifestyle reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Also with me is Joseph Hawkins, director of One National Gay and Lesbian Archives at the University of Southern California, which is the largest repository of LGBTQ materials in the world. Now, Arit, anybody who knows me at KPCC knows I'm all about the donuts. So can you tell us a bit about Cooper Donuts? What happened there, and why is it so significant as a site of resistance and demand for equality by LGBTQ people in the city?
Cooper Donuts was an all-night diner in downtown LA, sort of in between some of the gay bars that were operating at the time. And one night, like police would sort of like go in and sort of like harass like the gay and transgender people who visited the coffee shop. And one night they attempted to arrest a few people and cram them into one police car. And people just sort of had enough of the constant harassment. And they started throwing stirring straws and like cups and donuts, whatever they could get their hands on. And the police let the people go and just left and then came back with reinforcement.
And this was long before Stonewall, correct?
Yes, this was May 1959. And so I think that it sort of highlights this like longstanding history of just like, all of the major uprisings are due to like, just trying to get to address constant police harassment. And just like sort of this era from like from Cooper Donuts onto Stonewall of people just having enough.
And Cooper Donuts is downtown L.A., 316 East 5th Street. I mean, is that Skid Row?
I think it's close to the area. And what's interesting is that, like speaking back on, like, the issue of memory, like, there, if you read some firsthand accounts of, like, where Cooper Donuts was, there are a lot of accounts that say it was on 5th Street. But then there have been people who've gone back and sort of tried to figure out where it was and believe it's at that current address, the one that we list in our story.
Near San Julian Park. Well, also write about the Yangna plaque, which commemorates a Tongva village located at what's now El Pueblo de Los Angeles Historical Monument. Describe this intersectionality of gay rights with an acknowledgement of the indigenous land. Why include a plaque there, and what does it mean for LGBTQ history?
I think it goes back to it's like this interesting intersection of like history being erased. Like before Spanish Spanish people came and colonized this LA area, there was a tribe that was already here. And you, like, there's been this, I mean, it's important to remember that this used to be Tongva land well before it was, California. And I think if you go back and like hearing that, like Tongva tribes, like actually believed in they supported the LGBT community and it called people two-spirited because they embodied both male and female identities. And knowing that long before homophobia or our modern culture that, and our, the movement for gay rights within our culture, there was a culture that lived here that embraced the LGBTQ community.
Well, that's really very fascinating. I had no idea of that. So we want to hear from you, our listeners. What are the LGBTQ landmarks in Los Angeles that mean the most to you? Give us a call, 866-893-5722. You can also tweet at AirTalk or leave a comment on the Facebook page. I'm Joseph Hawkins, director of the One National Gay and Lesbian Library and Archives. Tell me a little bit more about this meaningfulness of the Tongva people in the LGBTQ universe.
Well, there was a big celebration in the beginning of what Los Angeles was actually a sort of cattle town back in those days. And so it was a very small place, and a lot of the two-spirit peoples who lived in adjacent areas to here would have these two-spirit people who would cross-dress and who had lived their lives and were accepted. And then when white settlers came, they began to have some contention about that. One of the big celebrations was called All Fools Night, in which they had cross-dressing, and that created a big stir because they started to ban cross-dressing. And because of that, it targeted those folks as well as other people here in Los Angeles at the time. So in the late 1800s, the mid-1800s, it really altered the way that the entire community lived.
Wow. And who is Troy Perry, and why is his residence of importance?
Troy Perry established the Metropolitan Community Church. He's one of the great leaders from here in Los Angeles. He actually discovered or began to realize that he was gay and he was married and had children. And then he came out. And when he came out, he sort of threw his life into doing a ministry around LGBTQ people. And he developed the Metropolitan Community Church, which provided the space for the first synagogue here in Los Angeles. And so Beth Haim Hadashim. So those two entities, religious entities, are sort of tied together.
And Arit, you wrote about the Reverend Perry's residence. It's in Huntington Park, but the congregation is in Los Feliz.
There are dozens or hundreds of branches across the country and across the world. And it was interesting that that initial congregation has moved around so many times because of arson, because of various other issues. But yeah, there is currently a branch in Los Feliz, and that's sort of almost what sparked the story for me, because when I moved back to LA, I lived in that neighborhood and I would walk by the church and I would just think, oh, there's a church nearby. But then it goes back to the idea of how you can live in a city, be born here, walk around and see all these landmarks and not realize the history until you actually take a step back and really research.
Oh, for sure. Well, let's hear from Jesse of Echo Park. Jesse, tell me about this nightclub in the Hollywood area.
It was called Does Your Mama Know? It was an after-hours spot. I haven't been there in about 20 years, but back in the days, that's where we would go, to end up our nights.
Well, walk me in there. What would it be like to go in?
It was just a nightclub with the DJ, music playing, and everybody dressed a bit weird. It was a place to go and wind down. It was on Saturday nights.
Oh, my God. So much fun. Well, thanks very much. We appreciate your call. And so, Arit, one last place. Where would you want to identify? I think we're running out of time. Oh. Last landmark. Just throw one out.
I guess I'll go back to the Metropolitan Community Church in Los Feliz.
And Joseph, last landmark.
Pershing Square, the Los Angeles Science Fiction and Fantasy Society used to be on Bixel. Those are both great places.
Awesome. Well, thank you both. Our guests are Arit John, lifestyle reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Also, Joseph Hawkins, director of One National Gay and Lesbian Archives at the University of Southern California, USC, the largest repository of LGBTQ materials in the world. Thank you both for joining us. Larry is back next week, and we'll be back at the microphone telling you all the good stuff about L.A. This is Air Talk, 89.3 KPCC.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.